All right, Alexander, we are here with Stanislav. Stanislav, good to have you back on the Duran. Where can people follow your work?
Alex, always a pleasure. Substack is Zmei Garenich, which, by the way, is a mythical three-headed dragon in Russian mythology. It was the only cool thing left that wasn't taken already on Substack. X is Stanis Karpivnik. Couldn't fit the whole name in. So on YouTube, at Mr. Slavic Man, all one word, Slavic with a K. And then on, let's see, Telegram. Yeah, that's we still have that. Telegram, Stas Today Obratna is the Russian channel. Stas was there is the English channel. And there's a little
All
bit
right.
different content on those two, depending. So check them both out. So
Okay,
there,
I
I think
have
that's
those
everything.
as yeah, okay. Well, I have the links as in the description box down below, and I will also have them as a pinned comment as well. So definitely check out Stanislav's work. Alexander Stanislav, let's get into the news.
Let's indeed do so. And what we're going to be very privileged, as always, to talk with Stanislav, and we're particularly privileged today because we are in the middle of two wars. One war is playing out in the Middle East. It is between the United States and Iran. We have constant shifts and changes of position by the United States. One day they're trying one thing, next day they're trying something else. It's extremely difficult to keep up with the differences and changes that happen from 1 hour sometimes to the next. The other war, which is the one that's been fought in Ukraine, which we've discussed with Stanislav extensively also, is the war between the Russians and the Ukrainians, though, of course, the Western powers are very heavily involved and implicated in that war too. And the two wars, to a civilian eye, which is mine, could not be more different. One, as I said, is constant, big actions, flashes, attacks, drama, excitement, and then it all stops and nothing seems to be resolved. The other war, which is the war which the Russians are fighting, very methodical, very systematic, very incremental, completely different. Now, we have all sorts of personalities. It's one war seems very personality driven, which is the war between the United States and Iran. The other war, the one in Ukraine, seems to be much more institution driven, in the sense that one gets the sense that it's more the general staff, the defense ministry, the groups of forces, the Security Council at the center of the political system. And again, the feel of it is very, very different. Now, I'd like to discuss all this and to compare these two wars and to look at where each of them is going. And I cannot imagine anybody better to do that with than Stanislav, who has close familiarity with both militaries in the sense that he served in the one and he has many acquaintances and knowledge of the other. So, firstly, Stanislav, welcome to this program. But
Thank
secondly,
you.
am I right in saying that there is a fundamental difference and it's a difference of character and that it goes beyond the person of the President of the United States? There does seem to be a major difference in the style of war, the way of war that these two militaries have. Am I right in this? And then maybe we can unpack this a little bit in a little bit more detail.
Alexander, you're absolutely right. I would add, I would slightly correct you. There isn't two wars, there's three wars. Because what's been flying under radar, and I've done, I'm about to put out a big article in the Russian media on it, and I've done an update on this, is the war in Africa, which is an extension. You could call it an extension, but it's a very different war. It's not just Mali, it's also Niger. They've been attacked. Niger was attacked first. Mali was invaded by 12,000 separatist and Islamic jihadists with American and French backing on the one side, and lots of Ukrainians because they've also published photos of themselves training and holding Islamic jihadist flags because they like to do that. They like to brag. On the other side is the Russian military, and this is granted, it's a former, a lot of these guys are former Wagner, but the Russian African Corps is active duty Russian military. They're all contracted with the military, the Department of Defense, and they've been upgraded a lot since Wagner. They've had heavy equipment brought in, a lot of it. And there's lots of Russian military all over that place. And it's not just two separate powers. Burkina Faso also sent troops instantly over to Mali to help assist Mali in holding off the invasion. And the Russian troops are in the middle of it. They're the sturge on which all the defense has been built. They've been upgrading the Malian military, all the Sahelian militaries. So we're really looking at three theaters already, and they may be growing, especially depending on what happens May 9th. I'll be there on the parade with RT. So if something hits, I'll be there videotaping, I guess. So you can have a direct look from me if we're all still alive the next day. So there's that. When it comes to military, yes, I'm very close with the Russian military. I actually, when mobilization hit, I requested a military commission as an officer. Had a couple of generals backing me, but the military they turned it down. And you could say, they said, we have enough officers for now, is what they came back with. And you could say that, you know, okay, I was a U.S. Military officer, maybe they don't trust me or something like that. But the key here is I have a lot of friends that are retired Soviet and retired Russian military from the 90s. Officers, all, you know, mid-ranking senior officers, they all wanted to come back, and they were all told the same thing. We have enough officers. Your time hasn't come yet. And the key being your time, and this was in 22, 23. And to read that is, at least if not the political class, then the military class is already planning for the big war with Europe. And they've recognized that there's a very good chance that this is all going to snowball effect into an avalanche that's going to drive war. So the officers that are more experienced, they're keeping them in reserve for when the big mobilization has to hit. It's military is obviously every single military in the world that's worth anything, including obviously the U.S. military, they will game play different scenarios. I mean, the U.S. military has game plans for every nation, for alien invasions, for zombie apocalypses. And it's people laugh at that. But what you're really doing is you're exercising the staffs to think of to come from different angles and think of new problems or solutions to problems that you normally wouldn't think, you know. A million zombies are heading your way. They're not going to stop. What do you do? Okay, what do you plan? You start planning logistics. It's an exercise. It's a mental exercise that can later on be used in different other scenarios that are real life scenarios or real life. But the approach between the Russian military and the American military, it is very different on a professional level, in that in the U.S., it's the art of war. And I think that comes more from Clausewitz and that school of thought and into the art of war. So what the art of war says is you learn what the great military leaders have done, how they've thought. You try to figure out Napoleon's thinking on a strategic theater tactical level, because it's an art. And in the end, it all depends on the person more so than on the system. The Russian approach is the science of war. There's full academies for this. It's yes, the individual commander is important. Yes, his abilities are very important, but those abilities are built upon a scientific mm-hmm. approach. How do you organize logistics? How do you organize defenses? You don't wing it. You actually have a science behind it. What's worked? What hasn't worked? And because of that, The system is less flexible maybe than the Western system or the American system, mm-hmm. But it's very quick at learning lessons. You survive any kind of setback. You learn from that setback. You dissect it. You do lessons learned much more so than you do from an American point of view. Lessons learned. You look at it at the minimal details of what went wrong, and you don't repeat. Mm-hmm. While from the American side, you may wind up repeating in a slight variation over and over and over again. A prime example is Bora Bora, or is it Tora Tora? I can't remember. I get those two mixed up. The one in Afghanistan. if you look at what was done when they went after bin Laden in the small mountain range, every single mistake the U.S. military has ever done before, it repeated. To and include, if anybody has ever seen or read the book, We Were Soldiers Once and Young, and the movie with, let's see, who was in that? That was Bruce Willis. Bruce Willis, if I remember correctly, right? Well, yeah, I think so. Well, whichever, right. When the 101st Airborne became 101st Air Assault, so they're helicopter borne. And what they did was they flew a brigade right into the middle of a division of Viet Cong in a valley, and they're surrounded.
Mel
now,
Gibson.
Yeah. Mel Gibson. Yep. Yep. You're right. You're right. You're absolutely right. Mel Gibson. So, and what do they find? Yes, we have the enemy where we want them. They're all around us. We're surrounded. We can shoot in any direction. They're all in there, but so can they. You know that, and that was a catastrophe that barely got saved by the sacrifice of a lot of helicopter pilots and a lot of luck. Because the enemy, yeah, first they're at shock, and then they go, "Wait a minute, is that it? Oh, we surround them. Yeah, they can't get out. They're trapped." Well, the U.S. military did the exact same thing. They repeated every single mistake. 101st Airborne or Air Assault brings in a brigade, drops it in the middle of the mountains, and now they're surrounded by the Mujahideen / Al-Qaeda / whomever else is up there. Every mistake, you would think that they would have learned, because it goes back more to the commander than to the science of it. So, yes, the U.S. is more flexible, but they tend to create a lot of stupid mistakes over and over again because it's not learned as a science, you know, what you do and you don't do. And the Russian approach is much more systematic. You know, we're supposed to be the low-skill, knuckle-dragging barbarians, according to the Western press. But the Russian approach has always been a very technical, very scientific approach to just about everything.
There's a big article which perhaps illustrates this very thing that you just said. I think it was in the New York Times about Russian adaptation to drone warfare and how the Russians have gone about reorganizing their drone warfare capabilities and have built up on a huge industry and whole science around the use of drones and have done this incredibly fast and done it upgraded by scale. And the very pragmatic and empirical way in which it's been done, in the sense that you look at what works and then you just build on it rather than sort of try and conceptualize it ahead. So it seems to me that it plays exactly to the point that you just made, that this is a structured approach rather than one that looks to try and wing your way through it. And which sort of, you know, tries to find some inspirational a solution to a problem. You actually sit down, you think, you have obviously the planning staffs to do it, and you approach it in that way. Does this have anything to do with Marxism? I get to ask that straight away, because the Soviet systems that we were all talked about, it was all supposed to be very much based on Marxism and the Soviet Union's approach to war was founded on, you know, thinking of people like Engels, or is it a pre-Soviet thing that extends back to the way the Russians have always waged war?
I'll answer this right now, but I also want to go back to the drones, because I just came back from the Donbass, and it's very important. Exactly, this is exactly where I was at meeting and seeing issues with the drones. So the approach. I know everybody likes to think history in Russia started in 1917. It didn't. It started somewhere in the 800s, the late 800s. Actually, the written history. Pre-Russian history was way longer than that. The Northern Slavs, at least 1,000 years before that, according to DNA analysis from the various remains of the Kurgans, R1A, Hopla group. But this approach started with Peter the Great. So when they started copying, they didn't just blindly copy Western European approaches. They set up committees. just about for everything. And they went about it in a very scientific approach, putting in, getting as much information as they could, putting in reports, then reviewing them, and trying to come at this at a technical scientific approach. Sometimes it took a lot longer. Sometimes it didn't work. But the mentality was already there. So did the Soviets enforce it? Probably did, even more so. But this was part of Tsarist Russia. This was part of Imperial Russia. And it became part of Soviet Russia. And it's part of modern Russia. It's been a traditional approach for the last 350 years, if not longer. And really, if you read some of the history of prior to Peter the Great, that there's already these approaches of expert committees looking at different situations, looking at canon use that started. I mean, Russia was one of the leading powers in the use of cannons back under Ivan Grozny, Ivan the Feared, Ivan the Fourth. This is the mid-1500s. And in fact, that turned several battles against the Mongol, the various Mongol Khaganats in the south. Mm-hmm. So this was a very scientific approach that has continued to be used. And drones, so I came back Monday evening from the Donbass, and I was visiting several units. I'm not going to say which or where they're located, but they are now reorganized as drone battalions and drone regiments. What happened before that is, and still to a degree is, but it's in the stage of transformation, reorganization, is everybody had their own drone section. So every assault company may have like two guys doing drones. A battalion might have, you know, a couple of sections here and there doing drones, and so on and so on. And, you know, there's lots of different drone missions. I'm not talking about strategic level drones, Garands, or any of these larger drones. And though Ukraine is hitting with airplane type drones deep into Russia, Russia can do the same thing. It's just not doing it because it doesn't need to right now. Because if it needs to go against the European Union, it can build those drones very, very quickly. It's building shorter range drones because it only needs to hit, at the moment anyways, to the western border of Ukraine. So that's what the Garand 3s. The Garand 2s are being used because it just doesn't need to go any further. And by the way, those drones are now very pilotable at the distances of Odessa, and not just at pre-programmed locations. They were taking out Odessan vessels who were trying to flee out of the port, and they were zeroing in on them. So it's either artificial intelligence or the new satellite systems or something else that are bouncing a signal off, and they're controlling them in real time to go against moving targets. Not just fixed targets that you can put on an internalized map. So, but the small drones, the tactical drones, you have several very different distinct missions involved. You have recon. You have bombing missions where they drop grenades or other explosive instruments onto targets. You have the kamikaze drone missions, which are one-offs. You have resupply missions, so there's drones that drop equipment, food, and so on. So these are very different drone missions, and they use different types of drones, even though they more or less, they kind of look the same, but the guts and the setup are different. The problem is until now, you would have these kinds of orders coming down to every single drone section from whatever commander's there. You know, oh, we need to do this today, tomorrow we need to do this, and 10 minutes later we need to do this. And it requires very different equipment and to some degree different training, obviously. Yeah. So it put a lot of strain and a lot of inefficiency in the system. A lot of it had to be repeated over and over again, capabilities at all of these units. So now they've gone to a reorganization where they're going now into battalion level and regiment level drone units. Well, you have dedicated units for resupply. You have dedicated units for kamikaze attacks or bombing mission. You have dedicated reconnaissance units. Because the other thing is, these guys, they'll carry these drones with them out into the field. They get as far as they can, particularly if they're using kamikaze drones. You need to get really far ahead. So they'll carry what they can. So they can't just switch over to reconnaissance that easily because the cameras are totally different. You know, you've got information acquiring packages on there that are absolutely different. Yeah, on a kamikaze, whether it's going by fiber optics or whether it's going by radio signal, you still have minimal camera use because you don't need very, very detailed photos from a height when you're zooming in on an enemy tank or enemy personnel to destroy them. So it's a different approach. So now you're coming with that organized scientific approach. And the other thing that that's interesting is, even though there are major manufacturers in Russia for the FPV, different kind of FPV drones, they have drone laboratories up front. And they, with 3D printers, everything's equipped, they can come up with whatever drone model that hits their fancy, right? You get a crazy idea, you go back in there, you describe it to the guys sitting behind the printers, they do a 3D model or modify the existing 3D model, they pump one out, you put it together relatively quickly, most everything is printed or soldered on the spot, and you go test it. So your turnaround period becomes much, much faster than having engineers in Moscow or in, you know, somewhere in Belgorod or wherever else they may be sitting. And I'm not saying they're sitting there, but they could be sitting there or whatever other part of Russia they're sitting, going, hey, let's make an idea deal. Well, then we get shipped it out there and then we test it, because once the enemy sees it, they're going to react and they're going to modify. And it's a continuous modification run. It's a continuous cycle. So the technology advancement and modification is extremely fast. We're talking very short technology cycles. What's good for now, maybe in 6 months, it's pointless. Nobody's using it anymore. It's much faster than it was in World War I and World War II. And that was pretty fast technology models. I mean, World War I, you started with the hot air balloons and ended with bombers, with four-engine Ilya Muromets bombers bristling with machine guns in every direction that the Germans wouldn't even go up against them because they get shot down. You went from that to that in a matter of 4 years. Here, the technology cycle is even faster, much faster. So, yes, they're coming at us very scientifically. They're totally reorganizing. There's a huge drive for people. And you know, the interesting thing is, it's a career move. Because not only you're serving the country and defense, you're building the skill set from design to operation of drones, that once peace comes, and hopefully we're still alive and it's not the peace of the grave, or nuclear peace, hopefully, you know, technology moves forward, these people will have very good career opportunities, because drones are here to stay in the civilian market too, for obvious reasons. So yeah, it's become a very organized, very structured move forward.
I've actually heard it described that, you know, Rubicon is Russia's leading tech company at the moment.
Yep. And that's been,
now, can you just tell us something else about drone warfare? Because there's a certain degree of commentary, which is on the Ukrainian side, by people who are very critical of Ukraine's way of using battlefield drones, that the Ukrainians overemphasize killing infantry, killing Russian infantry with their drones, whereas the Russians see drones primarily as useful to disrupt logistics, Ukrainian logistics and supplies. And I've read many commentaries from various Ukrainian commentators who say that the Russian approach is ultimately far more effective. Did you hear anything about that whilst you were there in Donbass?
Yes. There's several key points here. First of all, Ukraine has to compensate for men and lack of trained men. A friend of mine, he used to be in storm infantry. He is now on the cleanup crews. So Kupins, by the way, has fallen. He was just in Kupins before he got transferred to a different unit. Kupins has fully fallen. There's a couple of buildings on the very edge, and the forest past Kupins, the Ukrainians are still holding. And they were trying to make up manpower losses, and they're catastrophic manpower losses with drones to try to hold the Russian infantry in place with drones. And when I say cleanup crews, he went from he got injured when he was in the storm infantry. So they transferred him after he recovered from his injury, shrapnel injury. They clean up the corpses. He said, you know, on a static piece of battlefield just south of Kupins, where you'd think that it went back and forth several times, but you would think that the casualties would be equivalent or something close to equivalent, especially since Russia in the end pushed the Ukrainians out, and the Ukrainians are on defensive, you think there'd be a lot more Russian casualties. She said 10 to 1. It was shocked. I mean, just the Ukrainian casualties, just the corpses were just literally stacked on top of each other. They were just falling in the same places, in the same areas. And they're cleaning that up. They're 10 to 1. So it's not just the matter of Russia's advancing, even on a more static battlefield. That's what it's hitting. And they're throwing people in. You know, friend of mine was telling me when he was on defensive positions up in in the Kharkiv Oblast, they had a 2-kilometer open field in front of their positions. Ukrainians would just drop off. And we were discussing how they were moving. So from the way they were moving, it's obvious these guys had zero training. You know, they were told which end of the rifle was the business end of the rifle. That's it. Now go scream hurrah for Ukraine, glory to heroes, and go die. And they were just bringing them up in huge numbers. These press gang meat. I mean, that's all they are to the Ukrainian leadership. And charging them across a 2-kilometer field. It's like, we barely ever fired on them. The artillery took them all out. They would make it halfway across the field before they would be wiped out. So from that point of view, the Ukrainians, all they have is mass drone warfare. The Russian approach to drone warfare has changed too. And I'll go back to Ukrainian in a second too, because there's an element that everybody's missing. I'm one of the reasons why the Ukrainians are acting the way they're acting. The Russian approach has always been, take out the equipment. Now, the deep equipment hits, the logistic hits, are now done by the latest generation of Garand drones, which can be piloted, can be either autopiloted or piloted by the actual operator somewhere remotely in a different city. They don't have to be anywhere near the base because they're bouncing off the satellites. And they can be used to strike moving targets in 100 kilometers, 150 kilometers out. So you'll get a grand drone hunting down a truck, for example. You can do that. It's a little expensive, but deep enough, it happens deep enough that you can't get the FPV drones that far in. Russia has usually targeted technology over personnel. But war makes people mean, and it gets a meaner. For a lot of drone operators, the emphasis has changed. They're targeting, unless it's something that's very key, they're now targeting the Ukrainian personnel first and foremost. And that's more of a revenge thing for what the Ukrainians do, especially what the Ukrainians do to civilian population. Now, from the Ukrainian side, ever heard of gamification? The Ukrainian units are literally, you gamify everything. When you play a game on a telephone, these fast games. The key in those games is at least every 3 to 5 seconds, something pops up, some little point, you get awarded some little point, you get that little bit of dopamine rush. And that is the gamification of something. Anything you do, that's the design model of the last several years, is to get mini dopamine rush. That's what TikTok is based off of, why teenagers get addicted to watching 10-second or 15-second videos that are pointless, but they get a little dopamine rush. It's gamification. They get the bonus point. Well, the Ukrainian battalions or the Ukrainian drone operators, their units on different levels of their units, from companies to sections up to battalions, they're all on a gamification. They get points per strike. They earn these points as a unit, and then they get swag. They can spend these units at the end of the month on an internet. They order new trikes for themselves, or new motorcycles, or new other gear, and they get it. They actually will get it. So the motivation is, you got to kill something. So if you've got no military targets, civilians also get your points. Less points, but they get your points. So they will always go after somebody. I did, one second. I did an update. I haven't put it out yet, but part of my update for yesterday, this is typical, on the Russian, on this battlefield. Actually, it's not on the battlefield. This is civilian casualties, for yesterday on the Russian side. And this happens every single day. The town of Zhukhanku, I'm butchering the name. I got to look it up exactly where it's located. I think it's in in the edge of the Caucasus. 5 civilians killed. Bryansk, 1 civilian killed, hit on a house. Logov, which is a village in Kursk, 2 civilians injured, hit on a gas station while they were fueling. Belgorod Oblast, 1 civilian killed, 3 injured. That's every single day. They can't find military targets, so they can't approach military targets because they have protection. They go after civilians to earn points so they can get swag. That's a gamification on the Ukrainian side, the psychological gamification of this war. Which is, by the way, why the Ukrainian drone operators don't get taken as prisoners.
I've heard it said that this approach of basically paying operators for the number of kills they achieve, that the other thing it is doing is encouraging massive inflation in terms of the numbers of soldiers, yeah, Russian soldiers, and that they say that they've killed, and that this is one of the factors that is distorting understanding in the West. I mean, is that right?
Yes, and then there's the NATO kill tables. Ever heard of the NATO kill tables? Okay, so on a strategic theater level operation, you have quite literally, now this is hangover from the Cold War where you're supposed to have these gigantic battles, and you know, you're firing thousands of rounds of artillery in the first days on all the fronts as the Red Horde comes rolling over the valiant NATO defenders. We know the scenarios. You know, it's been gamed all over the place and computer games and television shows and so on. Well, there's no, especially back then without drones, there was no way that you can estimate what you're actually killing. So NATO came up, and the U.S. military has these and used to use them, came up with kill tables. So you look at the weapon system. Say you're firing 155 millimeter howitzers. And you fired, you go across and it's a table. It's quite literally a table. So you're fighting a infantry, brigade, right? And you fired off 100 rounds in a square, in a square kilometer or 2 square kilometers. You go across 155 millimeter, how many rounds you fired. And you look what the table tells you. You should have killed 200 infantry, 5 BMPs, and so on. And they quite literally use these tables, at least they used to at the beginning of this conflict, to come up with the death rates of the Russian military. Were they based in any kind of actual factual information or even to the concept of how this conflict was being fought? Absolutely not. Absolutely not. But they were used, and this is why you got these giant wild numbers of 12,000 Russian tanks destroyed by 2024 and, you know, 30,000 BMPs and other vehicles and so on. They're just pulling this off of the tables. How many shots did we fire? Okay, so if we fired 300 155 millimeter shots, or we fired so many MLRS short range rockets, now we should have killed this, 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 and this. And that goes into reporting. We killed this. And quite literally, that's where a lot of this statistics is coming from. It's idiotic. It has absolutely no concrete concept in modern warfare, at least the modern warfare as we're seeing it right now, because it was based off of giant kill ratios that should have happened when the entire Red Army with all the Warsaw Pact countries comes rolling over. So we can approximate what we've killed. But they were used, and they may still be getting used in some areas.
Yeah. I'm sure they are. Let's go back to the command and control systems and the way in which war is fought. Because, of course, what you say is actually very interesting, that on the one hand, you have commanders who are playing Napoleon. I think exaggerating, but that's what they're doing.
No, it's not. You're not.
and on the other hand, on the other side, you have basically a much more systematic, almost like a kind of a machine war. Now, does that explain something which I think a lot of people find very difficult to understand, which is why the Russians are fighting this war in this particular way, why they're not going for particular knockout blows in the kind, you know, grand strategic plans of, you know, they're not trying to do an Austerlitz, for example. They are taking everything very systematically and very methodically, be it, you know, a place like Konstantinovka or in Lyman or wherever It's unspectacular. It's not dramatic, but it is remorseless. And it means that when you finally take the territory, once you've consolidated, you keep it. So does this explain one of the differences that in the West, we are always looking for this, you know, grand tactics, this brilliant, inspirational general who's going to achieve this tremendous knockout victory, whereas this isn't what the Russians do at all. If you could just talk to that a bit.
Yeah, the problem, if we were going to look at it honestly, there is no Austerlitz for the last 120 years. Those moments, and one could probably say there hasn't, they started to fade out with the Franco-Prussian War. Because even though the Franco-Prussian War had some very key battles that helped crush the French army, nowhere did the French army fully just collapse. You no longer have Austerlitz, you no longer have Borodino, you don't have these kinds of battles where you may be wagering the entire future of your entire nation on one battle. Simply put, too many men, too long of a front, as we saw in World War One, as we saw even on the Eastern Front, which was relatively a mobile front compared to the West, which is all trench. The Eastern Front was relatively mobile. It still had a lot of trench warfare in it, but it was just too big. World War Two, you had major losses like Stalingrad, just as an example, that did not crush the German army. Kursk did not crush the German army. It was a major setback. It was a major loss. But the front continued fighting because it was just too big now. So it's the same thing in here. You know, any one city, any one major victory, but the front is over 1,200 kilometers long. And even if a portion of the front collapses and starts retreating, doesn't mean everybody starts retreating. Communications themselves, by the time you find out that, oh, they're retreating up north where, you know, somewhere around Kharkov, and we're sitting down in Zaporozhye, oh, it's been 3 days. Well, we're still holding our own because we're not being surrounded. So it's a whole different scale, absolutely whole different scale. You know, naval battles could still be something of that sort, I guess. I'm not a naval officer. I've read naval history and some strategy, but I'm no stratagem for naval battles. But on the ground, no, it's impossible now for countries the size of what we're talking about. Now, if we're talking smaller nations that don't have the larger militaries, yes, one big battle could decide the fate of a small nation. But then again, the frontage is different, the amount of men is different, everything's different. But even if we look at the Paraguayan war, where almost 50% of the manpower was killed, that war
fought
was
in the middle of the 19th century, just to make sense, fought in the middle of the 19th century, just for those who don't know about it.
Exactly. You know, one of the things that the American and the Union and the Confederate generals were accused of during the American Civil War is all of them wanted to be Napoleon, but none of them had the capability to follow through. So they could defeat their enemy on the battlefield, but they couldn't run them down and destroy them. So the enemies, even though there was very successful definitive battles that destroyed one or heavily damaged, they never destroyed any armies, heavily damaged one army, the other, they'd retreat, regroup, and then go at it again. There was never this definitive conquest. Even that really was already going out the window with Napoleon. I mean, the days where, you know, one warlord lined up his 500 or 1,000 men against men at arms and knights against another, and they fought it out, and that could be the end of one kingdom or another, they're done. And they're never going to come back on a large scale. So there's that. And that makes a very different approach. But, you know, if you look at these major battles, we can start with Snake Island, which is there may be some Ukrainians sitting there. It's I think nobody's sitting there now. It's a very pointless piece of land. But it was a PR battle, and that was being organized by the British versus Kursk and Zaporozhye. Rabotina was organized by the Americans and planned out. But what I mean by organized, I mean literally the battle was planned. The Ukrainian generals are just the executive branch. They're the execution portion. They don't make any of the plans. They just follow through on them or not follow through on them. And there were a lot of people that were lost on Snake Island. You look at the approaches the British were playing. They were just playing with people because it's not their people. And they're not going to be punished if it's a failure. Yeah, let's experiment. So, okay, a couple hundred guys get killed here, a couple hundred guys get killed there. It's not our people. It's not going to really reflect on my career. I'm learning. And Kursk, if you look at it, same thing. If you look at it from a strategic point of view on a big picture, nobody would have gone into Kursk. Kursk was an idiot move. It was a good PR move at first for a month or so, but until the front stabilized. But it was an absolute idiot move. They never took more than 15% of Kursk. Okay, so except for maybe going after a nuclear power plant and committing nuclear terrorism, what good were you going to do? Those forces were incapable of even reaching Kursk City. And if you even got that, the most you can hope for is an internal Russian political collapse. And that was like betting on one of these mega lotteries that, you know, gives you the 1 in a billion chance of winning, which is basically the same thing. And you pulled up your deep reserve into a kill sack, into a giant kill sack. So anybody who looked at it from the side would have gone, no, this is stupid. This is absolutely idiotic. This is not going to get you anywhere except for a few good PR pictures for a while until it turns bad PR. But it was planned. It was executed as the swaggered, we're going to march into Russia and we're going to make glory and all that. And it ended, it ended as it could never have ended any other way, except the total extermination of the forces that went in there. And they should have pulled out of there when they saw that set. We can't move forward. You put up some blocking forces and you get the hell out. We've raided Russia. They could have saved some, but no, you know, it was, they held to the end and they died in the end. And now Russia is moving on to Sumy, and Sumy is going to be the next big battle. Russian forces in the north of Sumy are less than 10 kilometers outside the city limits. I mean, it's a nice afternoon walk, quite literally, at this point. So, and that all goes back to Kursk, right? Because they weakened themselves so much, 80,000 dead, and I don't know how many wounded, that they didn't have a capability of holding off anymore. But Russia is approaching this in a very systematic move for now. But I'll tell you this. The age, I'm not going to say drones are ever going to leave. They're not going to leave. They're part of the battlefield. But the age of drone prominence may be coming to an end, much quicker than most people understand. And there's been a lot of systems, anti-drone systems have come out. Everything from shotgun blasts and net shots, down up to lasers. Russia, China, America, because America wound up shooting a party balloon on the Mexican side of the border with a laser. Yeah, they've got the laser system. You just can't tell the difference between a drone and a party balloon. Which only confirmed they do have the laser systems. Lasers are great. They melt right through these drones in less than a second. But the problem is they can only service one target at a time. If you have one target, you're great. If you are being swarmed by 30 or 40 drones and coming from a wide area approach, you can't service those targets, and the destruction of one of those lasers is pretty expensive. So everything you've had right now has been point defense systems. You can service one target at a time. With drone warfare, you need an area defense system. And the Chinese have just come up. The only thing that can do this, really, because once Russia came up with the fiber optics, and of course Ukraine did copy that, and we see fiber optics being used in Mali, by the way, by the Malian army with their drone warfare units that were set up by Russia. Once you've got that, you cannot block the radio signals. You can't do white noise. You can't jam them, because everything's going up that the wire. But what you need is an area effect weapon that could do that, and that's called an electromagnetic pulse. Now, nuclear weapons, when they explode, the first thing they do is they release an electromagnetic pulse, which is a high-energy, photons. Actually, not photons. I'm sorry. They're photons of light. They are... it's high energy particles. I can't think of their name at the moment, unfortunately. But the high energy particles, they hit electronics and they hit wires. In fact, by the way, they do great jobs at destroying long distance high voltage lines. We saw the solar flare back. Well, we saw our great grandfather's great grandfather saw the solar flare in the 1880s that burned out most of the communications at that time across the northern hemisphere. It was just a solar flare. Does the same thing. It builds up an electric charge on the chips, and they burn out. So it doesn't matter, you know, it's a radio signal or it's a fiber optic. Mm-hmm. Well, the Chinese have come up with this new system. Mm-hmm. It's a big microwave dish. It's a rectangular big microwave dish, fits on top of a basically a Humvee sized vehicle. It has the inclination declination of minus 5 to 50 degrees. It covers about 180 degrees. So it's an area effect. The radar system that's built in can spot a cross section of 0.3 meters by 0.3 meters at 5 kilometers. You know, surrounding dependent, of course. You know, if you're in a city area or you're in a heavy forest, it would be much less. But the fact is, and 0.3 meters is your average FPV drone. It's something about that big, flying at 5 kilometers. It can be picked up, and the whole area is microwave. So yeah, birds will fall out of the sky. I've seen that happen on microwave dishes, communication dishes, and this is just on a bigger scale. Birds and insects will be dropping, but so will drones. I'm expecting that the Chinese have announced that they're field testing it in Chinese environments, but sooner or later it's going to go into field testing in Russia. That's guaranteed. So if this works as advertised, we could see a very rapid change in the battlefield.
I've actually, there was a report on TASS that Almasante, you know who they are, obviously, that they've actually been working on what sounded to me exactly the same kind of system. So it looks, I also think that this is coming, actually. Let's look at the other war, the one in the Persian Gulf, because, I mean, there's lots of people who criticize the Russian war. They say it's very slow, the advance is very gradual. We have had 40 days of intense fighting in the Persian Gulf, huge expenditure of equipment, which has achieved what exactly? I mean, I'm asking you this question because it seems to me that this is the contrast. I mean, the one may be slow, but it's purposeful, and it is gradually moving forward. The other has used up apparently half the inventories, because that's what they're saying.
What has it
actually achieved?
Much more.
More. Okay. Well, tell us.
For the PAC-3s, Larry Johnson did a very good job on calculating the PAC-3s. Yeah. I'm not even sure how many PAC-2s have been used up, but probably a very large quantity of PAC-2 Patriot missiles. Basically, the PAC-3s, we're looking at about 90%. And the problem is, even though the military-industrial complex has promised Trump to triple production, you know, go from 60 missiles to 180 missiles a month, so from maybe 30 targets to, 90 targets, which still wouldn't cover one night in Ukraine. The problem is rare earth magnets. You know, the purified form of the rare earth, which are all magnetic, are something the U.S. doesn't exactly produce much of. They've set up one plant. They produce an extremely high cost, very small amounts, not enough to feed the military industrial complex. Everything comes from China, and obviously Bessett's doing his best to make sure the Chinese are as pissed off as humanly possible at the Americans. And Trump does his part too on that. So how are they going to build those? I don't know. That's a big question. What has it accomplished? Well, let's begin with, you know, everybody started with General Milley. The Russians are going to take Kyiv in 3 days. That's where this myth started. Russia was never planning on taking Kyiv, because Russia made a very big mistake in thinking that it could, it almost succeeded until Johnson showed up, that it could just scare the Ukrainians and destroy the Ukrainian potential to invade the Donbass and scare them into being neutral. And they almost succeeded. And then Johnson shows up, and we know the history of that. So Russia went, Russian plans went very askew. But they learned. It may be slower than most people. You know, I was one of the people calling that we needed mobilization back in the summer, not in October. There's a lot of people, a lot of generals are calling we need mobilization now, not to wait. But the political side tried to still negotiate and then finally came to the conclusion that this isn't going to work. We're losing because we quite literally do not have the manpower to hold the battlefield. We need more manpower. Russia learns systematically and adjusts. The U.S. literally came in with, this will be over by the end of the weekend. They were literally, I don't know what the generals were telling. We know Keenan at least told Trump because it got leaked in the media that we do not have the assets, even after they built up the assets, because Trump originally wanted January 16th, not February 28th. They brought in a lot more assets into the theater of operations, but Keenan, it got leaked that we're not going to accomplish anything. We don't have what we need. And that got ignored. Network, literally, they bought off on Netanyahu's fairy tale of 4 days or 3 days. We just kill the Khomeini and it all collapses like a house of cards. The West loves the silver bullet approach to everything. We'll kill the werewolf with one silver bullet. It just never works, but they keep trying that, which I guess is the definition of insanity. Same thing under same conditions and expecting different results. But once that didn't work, what's the plan? Well, there is no plan. We're winging it. And what America always goes back to when it starts winging things is striking civilian population centers, mass casualties as much as possible to try to force the civilians, to force the government to surrender. It has never worked. It did not work in firebombing 5 million Germans to death and burning them in every single German city in Germany, not just Dresden, like everybody remembers. It did not work firebombing the Japanese in one air raid on Tokyo. They killed 500,000 people. It did not work in Yugoslavia, even when they were hitting maternity wards and open air markets. It didn't work anywhere. It has never worked. People rally around the flag. They may not like the government, but they know who's killing them, and it's not their government. Nationalism skyrockets at this point. So no matter who you are, it's an internal issue, what I don't like about you or the way your policies, but that's the enemy that's trying to kill my kids and my family and my friends, and we're going to go fight them. That's the human mentality. It's always rally around your own, except for very few exceptions. And that's what they fell back on. But the problem is Iran has been getting ready for 20 years. So we've downgraded them by 30%, 80%, 90%. You know, Trump said it very correctly. We've decimated them. You may have triple decimated them. So they may be down about 30% for the actual definition of that word. So maybe you triple decimated them, which means they still have 70% of capabilities fighting. They're buried under mountains, literally under mountains of granite that you would have to have several nuclear strikes to try to bury. They're inaccessible to the U.S. short of ground troops going in. And the U.S. physically does not have ground troops capable of doing this. Because one of the approaches of all this is called logistics. And logistics for the U.S. is a nightmare. Manufacturing for the U.S. is a nightmare. It cannot manufacture the supplies it needs to keep the people in the battlefield. And two, what we saw in Ukraine is still in effect. Amazingly, it's not just American satellites overhead. Not only do the Iranians have a few satellites of their own, but apparently there's Russian and Chinese satellites. And somebody may be leaking targeting information to the Iranians, apparently. That's hard to believe, I know. The U.S. could get proxied. And that's what we're facing. The U.S. may be, you know, from information I've gotten tonight, Trump may be restarting the bombing campaign. He's got a limited amount of missiles left. I don't know what he could do with it, but I don't think they know what to do at this point. They're lost. They're grasping at anything and everything.
Yeah. Okay, so let's just finish with this question, because of course there's been a lot of discussion about the state of the war in Ukraine. Very, very quick rundown. What is going on? I mean, I was reading just before we did this program that the Ukrainians are retaking territory and that they're advancing in all sorts of places and that Moscow is in their sights. it's exaggerating slightly. But tell us what's happening. Maybe you could tell us a bit about, because this battle of Konstantinovka, which I noticed that the media in Britain and the West is very careful to avoid talking about. There's now been an article in Reuters that has finally admitted that there is actually a battle going on there. But tell us a little bit briefly about where
there is a battle going on. They're a little late to the game, but you know, never mind.
Well, no.
Yeah, in fact, after this video, I'm taking my shovel. I'm on the next work crew digging anti-tank trenches to stop the Ukrainians. It's our fifth or sixth line of anti-tank trenches we're digging. So, you know, we're preparing. Any day now, they'll show up near Moscow. We've been waiting for 4 years, and they're going to show up, and we'll be fighting them hand-to-hand. And then there's reality. And the reality is much less pleasant for the Ukrainian side. What we've got, they are taking some areas back in a very limited format in Zaporozhye, which they've been counterattacking and getting counterattacked and counterattacking in Zaporozhye since, I guess, about February, when all this started up relatively quickly and back and forth. And they're throwing everything they can because once Oryokhovo falls, there's really nothing to hold on to in Zaporozhye Oblast except Zaporozhye City itself. And that's pretty untenable. So they're doing counterattacks so much as they can, but outside of huge losses, so they don't have staying power because they use up so much of their forces to break into some area that then they can't dig in. They don't have the forces to dig in and hold. Now, going north of Zaporozhye, Russian forces, there's slow advance up and down in the Donetsk area, very limited in former Pokrovsk area. It's for that area, it's relatively limited because most of the fight is in Konstantinovka, and Konstantinovka is more than half in Russian hands, and the Ukrainians they've been holding off with drones. They don't have enough personnel. They've tossed everything they had in there. And one of the things, by the way, when we go back down to Zaporozhye, they gain ground by using their more elite units. The problem is they lose a lot of people in those elite units, so they can't reconstitute them fast enough. And then they pull those units back and they push in the press gang people. And the press gang people, they don't want to fight. They're not trained. They may not surrender. Surrendering is very dangerous because, by the way, those Ukrainian drone units also get points for killing their own guys if they're trying to surrender. And some of them are quite literally, as they're blocking you, all they do is they hover near their guys and wait for somebody to try to surrender to take them out and earn more points that way. It's very cynical. I mean, it's an extremely cynical approach, but they will run. So these guys, when the Russian forces start approaching within hand grenade range, they're usually breaking and running for it. And maybe long before that. Because they're not trained, they're not motivated. We've seen photos of the guys that have been taken prisoner during combat operations. Pretty dangerous to try to surrender during active combat operations, obviously. Everybody's adrenaline's up. And I will tell you, they look like they've come out of concentration camps because they're not being fed. The logistics system is broken down, especially for these guys, the press gang guys. I mean, they're starved, their skin and bones bruised up. They look like crap. And to consider that these are your frontline troops, you know, that says a lot of the state of the military in Ukraine. Now, going back up, Konstantinovka is going to fall, but what's even more important is Krasny Liman has basically been cut off. They try to do some limited counterattacks inside Krasny Liman against Russian forces in Krasny Liman, which even if they're successful, again, it's relatively pointless because you're throwing away men, you need a defensive on very limited tactical objectives on the offensive that you then can't hold anyways. So you may be buying yourself a couple days or a day or less at the expense of guys that you cannot replace. The main route of supply to Krasny Liman is fully under Russian drone and artillery and aviation control. So nothing gets in, nothing gets out for the most part. And then getting across the Oskol River is pretty difficult. We've seen the Ukrainians claim counterattacks, successful counterattacks from Sumy on down with these videos. But if you look at the videos like Sumy, for example, they had some Mirapolye. They had some videos that come out that they've counterattacked and taken back the village. But then you look at the tree line, and there's no leaves on the trees. I just came back from there. It's all green. So these videos came out 3 days ago. They've retaken it. And you look at the trees. So when did you take those videos? About February, when the snow, or early March, when the snow melted off. There's been very limited snowfall in a lot of those areas. So the trees haven't greened yet. Everything's absolutely green down there. Right now, it's basically almost summertime temperatures already. So you'd see these videos. So there, it's PR stunts. But the point is, so that area is taken. Kupinsk is gone. And the problem for the Ukrainians with Kupinsk, they're still holding on the force on the edges of Kupinsk. But that's all. That's very limited. They don't have the manpower. Russia is moving. So we're looking at the northeastern section of Kharkiv Oblast or province. So you have the Serebryanka River coming down, and then you have Kupinsk on this side. And what? And there's a big river. There's a big water reserve today. And this is just the east of Kharkiv. What the Russian forces are going to do is they're going to break through, break out, and they're going to charge across to the water reserve. And that cuts off, fully cuts off northeastern Kharkiv Oblast. And any Ukrainian soldiers in that area are screwed. I mean, they're logistically cut off fully. It's it'll take a while to clear them out, but unless they're going to try to run and then run 100 kilometers and then swim across a swollen river, they're screwed. They're not getting provision. They're barely getting provisioned as it is. They'll be fully cut off. So that area, Russia's already buffered in from every direction in that area. I think that area is going to fall relatively quickly now that Kupinsk is done. Kupinsk was the linchpin for that. But that will bring the Russian forces on the east within about 30 kilometers of Kharkiv. And Russian forces in the north of Kharkiv is now starting to move forward all along the borderline. But I think the big battle is coming first in Sumy. Russian forces are moving in from the east, but they're still about 30 kilometers away from Sumy in the east. But in the north, they're 10 kilometers out. That's an afternoon walk. That's a light afternoon. Mm. That's 6 miles for the Americans. They may be watching this and our standard system bound. That's not a far walk. Russia is in the middle of the second line of defensive belts. There is no third line except the city itself. The city is wide open. It's home to about in peacetime. It's home to about 250,000-300,000 people. It's flat. It's open, but it is a nexus of logistics, including down to Kharkiv. So once that's taken, you further cut off Kharkiv from the east, logistically wise. You limit the amount of bridges and roads that can be taken. And you open up Chernigov next. And after Chernigov is Kyiv. Never mind Kyiv coming across the Russian, from Bryansk into Chernigov. So this could be, it doesn't look like it at first, but this could be a very linchpin operation to take Sumy. And once those areas beyond Sumy are not built up, there are no defensive lines. And the Ukrainians have proven that they have limited scope of what they can bring into the area. And from the Russian side, it's about a division and a half fighting this battle. If Russia, now to remember this, there are over 350,000 Russian troops in the near reserve. They're being rotated. Battalions are being rotated in for a couple months, get combat experience, rotated back out, reconstituted. But there's over 350,000 troops that are not directly involved in these combat operations. It's two tank armies, basically. If they get tossed in large scale, sure, you will take lots of casualties at first as you're breaking through, but the collapse of a front line will more than make up for it. And if this microwave technology is a go, then your big aerial movements are back, because once you can suppress drones in an area, you have you have 5-6 of these vehicles driving, taking the birds and the electronic birds out of the sky, because they'll fry birds too. Like I said, it's microwave radiation. But once you've got that and you're taking out drones up front, that changes the dynamic totally, because that's all Ukraine has right now is a, quote, drone wall. They literally have 4 or 5 drones for every Russian infantryman coming out. Now, the majority of drones don't make targets. They lose them. They either get shut down or they hit obstacles and so on. But there's still quite more than a third that finds their targets. And that's been what has been holding things up. Now, even then, you get the problem of everything's green now. And vegetation, as we know, these drones are actually very fragile. If any of the propellers are taken or damaged, the drone just falls out of the sky. It can't stand in the air. So there's a lot of these options. If a lot, I think, is riding now if this Chinese technology that they've manufactured, and right, Russia's working on, everybody's working on, Chinese have beaten everybody to the punchline, just like they've done, by the way, with photonic cells for AI that are about 1,000 times faster than the best NVIDIA chips they can produce, which is a game changer. It's just starting to hit the market. The technology advance in China are very quick, are very, very quick. And it's just not being acknowledged in the West. If this comes in and this works out, this would rebalance the battlefield back toward large-scale movements, which would be disastrous for Ukraine.
Yeah. Stanislav, this has been an absolutely brilliant program. Thank you very much. And I look forward to speaking to you again.
Absolutely.
Stanislav, before you go, where can people follow your work?
Okay, so Substack, Zmei Garemich, on X, it's on at Stanis Krepivnik. Like I said, couldn't fit the whole name in. We Russians love long names. As we get smart, we have to learn how to read, how to spell our own names. On Telegram, it's Stasudai Abratna is the Russian, Stasus there is the English, and on YouTube, it's at Mr. Slavic Man, one word, Slavic with a K.
All right, those links are in the description box down below, and that's a pinned comment. Thank you, Stanislav.